Hey guys, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts of bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And one of them is Lisa, who will be introducing our speaker tonight.
I'm an alcoholic, and I wasn't sure what to say, so she suggested that she was like, well, why did you ask me to sponsor you? And I said, well, my sponsor fired me, because I'm a little bit defiant. But honestly, I had been talking to Jennifer and seeing her around meetings for about a year prior to asking her after being fired, and she has a tremendous sense of humor, and she doesn't take herself very seriously, and she's very active and helping a lot of women get sober. Being in a car full of alcoholics, that's how I got sober. That brings me back to my early days, and I hope I don't ever forget those. I hope they don't ever become the old days. So I introduce Jennifer. Thank you. Got to make sure I got all my stuff. I have to have my cough drops and my drink and my this and my that. My rose, which Debbie gave to me, because I apparently need a rose. Don't know why. Oh, ooh, a little table and everything. Okie dokie. My name is Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. We got down here kind of early from Gainesville, so we went by where I got my white chip, which was the Biscayne Room right over there. And it was so cozy in there, and they have lamps. I really approve of lamps. I do not approve of fluorescence. Make a note, Tim, would you please? It was really neat to be back there. I hadn't been in the place in 20 years. Let's see here. I made notes at work in case I forgot any of the big highlights, you know. But I'm not going to read them, really. I was born in Paris, France. Very fancy. My parents were American, but they were civilians in the Army, World War II, for those of you recently born. World War II! And they stayed in Europe after the war and had me. So you can't really say that I came back here because I wasn't really here. I was an egg and a sperm that came back here, so I suppose I came back here, but anyway. So I came here for the first time when I was about two. And we lived in New York City. And my parents thought it would be really fun. I don't know if they thought it was fun, but they thought it was a good idea if I went to French schools and spoke French all the time. Okay, then. So I went to French kindergarten and French everything up till the end of high school. But I was an American, and I was there for the alien. It was a private school, and it had a lot of pretty well-off kids from United Nations and, I don't know, businessmen who were living in the United States for a few years or whatever. Anyway, so some of these chicks had, like, Hermes scarves, you know, Gucci and this and that and the other. And I felt really like a dork, you know. But luckily they had a uniform. Navy blue on top, gray skirt, no pants. It's fine if girls freeze in New York City, but no pants. Thank you very much. I have a resentment. I need to write them. So I went to these French schools, and I do speak French. It's kind of interesting to speak French. I speak it in here. I speak a little bit of Spanish, too, enough to say, gee, the cat's in the street with my aunt. You know, something really, really helpful like that. But I have a really good accent in Spanish, so people go, oh, you know, and then they go, what did she say that for? My mother drank like a fish. Every night she drank. She drank martinis. They were made up of gin, and she would kind of look at the vermouth bottle. That was it. And then she'd pour the gin, and that was it. So she would drink those, and she was a businesswoman. She actually started the first spay-neuter program in the United States. But she, you know, there's a lot of paperwork and stuff to do. So she did that during the day, and then she'd come home, and my father would come home, and we'd have cocktails. And this was back in the 50s. I was born in 51. And no, I don't look as old as I am. I know that. That's what's good about getting sober young, you know. You pickle yourself early, you kind of stay okay. So, my mother drank a lot, and I noticed it as a baby. Well, toddler. I remember we were in a restaurant one night, and I was about four. And I was singing with the piano guy. Apparently a very lively, outgoing kid at one point. And so I'm singing and dancing, and all of a sudden there was this, like, hush over where my parents' table was, and something had happened. I don't know what it was. And I do remember that my mother got sick in the taxi on the way home, or my father got her head out the window, I hope, anyway. But I noticed that. You know, I didn't know what it was. I knew something icky was happening. And I had that happen pretty routinely. And my father was an emotionally absent person. He was very reserved and very intelligent. He would research everything. He was really kind of a nice guy, but emotionally he was not there. And he would look at her as she fell on her ass in the Tavern on the Green restaurant and just kind of with nothing. No reaction, nothing. So I thought, well, I should do that too. So I started nothing. But it wasn't nothing because I was shoving all these feelings and being scared. And why is my mother acting that way? I was shoving it all down into this box. And I finally found out at age 39 why I was anxious all the time. Because when you suppress your feelings, they have to come out somehow. And they either come out in rage or they come out in anxiety and, unfortunately, tremendous diarrhea, which is slimming but not a very nice way to be. So I was... I was anxious. I didn't know what feelings were between people. My parents didn't really touch me unless they absolutely had to, you know, if I was sick or something. So when I found this out in 2008, if you aren't nurtured as an infant between 0 and 4, if you're not held and touched and handed to other people, you won't learn that other people are okay. So my reaction to other people touching me, like my parents' friends and stuff, was, you know, because that was bad. That felt creepy. So I was pretty much that way until I started drinking. I finished off the French schools, and I went to college at age 16 with minimal... I had good social skills in a very I'm-fine-all-the-time kind of way. You know, I wasn't particularly nerdy or anything. And but I was 16, and everybody else was more like late 17, 18. And I learned to drink in college. I learned to smoke pot in college. And I got more and more anxious as the first year went by. And I finally asked my father if I could come back to New York. I was getting so anxious that, like, the world would look gray. And I'd be shaking. And, you know, people would be smiling at me. And I'd be with people that were my friends. But the feeling, I didn't have it. It was like I was in this box, like in a gun turret or something. And so I went back to New York City to live with him and my stepmom. She was a peach. I wish she had more drinks than she had. They always measured everything. If they had champagne, they would measure it and make sure they each got just the same amount. Anyway, so I lived with them for a couple of years and asked them if I could go to a shrink because I knew I was nuts. So they sent me to a Freudian. You lay on the couch, you know. And she never said anything. Every once in a blue moon, she'd say, "What are you thinking?" I don't think she said feeling. You know, that's kind of pushing it. I think she said thinking. And it took me 2 or 3 years to tell her that one of the things I was most ashamed about was that I played doctor in school bus with some kids. You know, we were 3, 4, 5 years old. And then the driver caught us and told me that we were disgusting and horrible. And I couldn't tell my mother. I tried to. I remember I was sitting on the lid of the toilet, and she was putting on makeup or something. I tried to tell her that this thing had happened, and I couldn't tell her. I didn't know what I wanted to tell her, except that I felt like total crap. And so I carried that shame with me for a really long time. And now I can tell this whole room full of strangers. Because, you know, there's quite a few of us have been fooling around in the bushes out there with Susie or, you know, Bobby, Lou, or whoever. And it's normal, but I didn't know it was normal. I thought I was this, like, creepy little horny kid. And I really wasn't. I think some of it was because since nobody ever touched me, if you did touch me, it was like overdrive, you know? So I think that has something to do with it, because I've found that happened later in life, unfortunately. So anyway, I got a job in New York. I was going to the shrink, got a job. My second job was with Women's Day Magazine. I was a proofreader. And I worked right there on Times Square where the ball drops, you know. And I worked there for a few years. This is mid-70s by now. And I got fired because I told somebody else. The passive-aggressive behavior is not very effective. It feels good to tell other people what an asshole somebody else is, but it doesn't actually help you in the long run. So this guy I was working for found out that I told all these people that he was an idiot, and he fired me, which is, you know, kind of understandable. So I looked around, and I found something about computerized typesetting. You know, back in the old days, hot metal, they had hot metal and poured it, and there was, you know, look it up sometime, Google it. It's very interesting. It's sort of like they could fix this huge monster machine that was sitting tight to make newspapers and stuff, and they could fix it, and it was their baby. And then these computers would come along, and I got into it right at the right time. I sent out 100 resumes, and I got 60 answers back wanting me to train people or be involved in some way. This was back 76 or 77. So I ended up driving up to Connecticut and started working for this guy. He went bankrupt, then I, 20 miles the other way, God gave me another company that was doing the same thing. And this is in the middle of nothing in northern Connecticut. So it was funny that there were these two starter computer companies in the same place. But I got a job with them, and they started sending me around. Supposed to be in the northeast, but it was the south. I haven't mentioned drinking yet, have I? Drinking. Well, when I was 14, my father had left because he had found his true soulmate, or whatever she was, and I have a little resentment about my stepmother. But she was also a sad person, so. Anyway, when I was 14, I thought, I'm going to find out what this stuff is. See, we were a little bit on the fancy side, so we had carafes and decanters on the sideboard. So I poured myself something brown in a glass, about that much, and I went, tweak. And I went back to my room, and I sat on the bed, and I don't know if any of you have heard Clancy Eye from Up in the Sky, but he says it goes, and it went, and I felt good. I was calm. I wasn't anxious. I wasn't worried about a thing. And it was just a wonderful feeling. I physically felt warm and, you know, 14 years of all the time, and all of a sudden I went, and I was okay. And I thought, well, if I feel this good with that much, I'd have some more. So, of course, I tossed down the equal amount. That was probably like 8 ounces of scotch or something. And, of course, I was puking in 10 minutes. But, needless to say, one gets over the puking after one tries a few times. You know, it's like the first cigarette. So, I didn't drink regularly then. But I remembered the blue, and drank a little bit at camp, French camp. Drank in college. I did mention drinking in college, yeah. It was up in Maine. I had a bottle of Southern Comfort. I drank Southern Comfort because Janis Joplin drank Southern Comfort. You know, need I say more. And it tastes pretty good. I mean, not scotch or ugh. But anyway, I liked it. And people would come by my room in the mornings and have a shot, and by the time they got to the dorm, the classes and stuff, it probably wore off. It was so dang cold up there. So the company I was working for sent me down to Atlanta. And I ended up Powers Ferry Road. This is now in 1980. Am I losing time? Let me look in my very large phone. I got time. Okay, cool. 1980, so the convenient thing about living on 285 is that you can get off at any exit and there is a bar. And you can get drunk in the bar, and then you can kind of veer your way back onto 285 and try and find your way home. So I did that quite a bit. And there were a few men, by the way, in here in this life of mine. The first one's name was the same as my father's, and he was also emotionally unavailable. Smoked pot all the time. He's a very nice guy. Kind of like my father was a very nice guy. But I told him, we split up, and I told him I was really depressed, and he said, well, I guess that's your problem. And, you know, and that's what I had gotten. That was, I had limited experience with men, and that was the kind of response I got. So I felt like an empty nothing, you know. And so I lived with another guy for a year, and then he got too expensive. Some of these men got a little expensive. So anyway, back to 1980. So I picked up this guy at Copperfields one night. We don't have Copperfields anymore, do we? Anyway, it was like Applebee's, pretty much. And he was younger than me, and he was real tall, and he had freckles. I called him Spoff, sorry pile of freckles. And he drank way more than me, so obviously he was much worse off than me. And I was bailing him out of jail and giving him money at the end of the week, because he had to turn in his money because he collected insurance from very poor people, and they were probably paying way too much money. Anyway, so we finally broke up, and I was working down here with the typesetting business and traveling all over the place and training people. And I would get popcorn and a six-pack. That's pretty much a good dinner, I think, you know. And I didn't really like going to the motel hotel bars because those salesmen were just too sad and, of course, horny. And once in a while, I'd give one of them, you know, I'd do them a favor. You know, I felt bad. All right, you know. But most of the time, nah, I preferred my six-pack and the popcorn. So, anyway, why did I get sober? Oh, I was working, I got tired of all this lovely life on the road, in the airplanes, in the, I like the rental cars, the rest of it's not so good. So I went into business with a couple of salesmen from the company, who were both fruitcakes. And I was working on something one night. You may know this place, you know Scrooge's? Who's been to Scrooge's? It's still in business. Ah, well, that's where I ended up drinking, because I didn't have enough self-esteem to go to. There was a place back in the 80s called Elan, which means like energy or something in French. And I went to Elan once with my friend Ylva, who was Swedish, and she was drinking White Russians. She didn't know that there was a Russian in them. Like the vodka. She thought it was fluid milk. And she had about six of those, and all of a sudden she was like, and the problem was, we were in her car, and it was a stick shift, and I don't have a clue about a stick shift. So we were at Perimeter, I think is where that thing was, that place was. So we got in her car, and I was in the passenger seat, and she did the shifting, and I did the aiming of the car. And we got back to Peachtree Industrial, where we were living at that time, across the street from Scrooge's, very handy. Live across the street from Mini Mart for all your food and your bar and where I worked. So I could have walked home, but that's, you know, I have a car. I'm not like that fella going to get his 12 pack, you know, and having to walk across the street. I'm not like that. Oh, no. So I'd go to Scrooge's and get drunk. And so I was working on a job for IBM one night. It was making little slides on a little computer and very boring little things. And I was trying to do a good job. And I didn't drink that night because I had to get this finished by Monday. And I didn't drink Sunday. And I thought, you know, maybe I should just not do this. Now, this was March 18th, 1984. March 17th, I went into Scrooge's at midnight, and there wasn't anybody in there worth picking up. There really wasn't anybody in there at all. It smelled terrible. You know, back then you could smoke, and stale chicken fingers, and ugh. And I saw myself living this life of gaiety and joy, trying to find my knight in shining beer can, and no knights in shining beer can to be had out there. And something told me I better just cut it out, you know. About 4 months earlier, I had pointed my way across the street and gotten to my apartment complex. And I kept trying different townhouse doors, you know, one here, and I couldn't even read the number. I was so dumb. And I was floating above myself going, what the hell are you doing? You know, it was strange. And 4 months later, I went down to Biscayne, picked up White Chip. So my sobriety date is March 18th, 1984. And I'm 62. I was 32 then. And I strongly suggest to those of you who are younger than me, stick with it. There's a little thing. thing in here in step one on 12 and 12. It says, it's talking about how the first people in AA were pretty much just goners. You know, they were in asylums, their livers were shot, nobody had any hope for them, and they were just shot. But it is a tremendous satisfaction to record that in the following years this changed. They're talking about the younger folks starting to come in who hadn't hit that bad a bottom, who weren't living in a box under a bridge and all that silliness. They were spared that last 10 or 15 years of literal hell the rest of us had gone through. I was spared the last 10 or 15 years of literal physical hell, but I think emotionally where I was at was bottom enough for me, you know. So I got sober at Biscayne, and the anxiety was still there. I just wasn't medicating it anymore. But people were nice there. I didn't have to have sex with anybody in there. And they would talk to me anyway. It was very refreshing. It was a relief. And I made some really good friends, one of whom is Richard right over here. Yep, he was there when I got there. And we spent lots of years going every week after Labor Day, going down to Panama City Beach with Maggie Harrison and all the old farts who were my age now. It's strange, but anyway. And they were. It was. They're all buried? Oh, my. Well, I'm on the right side of the dirt. Thank you. hope to stay that way for a little while longer. Quit smoking in 92. Highly recommend. COPD is not a good thing, which I do not have, but I think because I quit a long time ago. I wrote these little notes about what is it about getting sober. Got married to somebody that I met when I was 5 weeks sober. Don't do that. He didn't stay sober. I did. I went to meetings every day at the Biscayne for 6 or 7 years. And he would get drunk, and he would have these mood swings. And he was, actually, it turned out I thought he was bipolar. But I ran into him. Well, I let him move in with me in 2010. I hadn't seen him in 20 years. I'd had to get a restraining order to get him out of my life in 1990. I let him move in because he had MS, and it turned out that his problem wasn't bipolarism. He was sober, technically speaking. It was narcissism, which is self-centered on steroids. I came in one night, and he bitched at me about something. Narcissists like to bitch about stuff. And he bitched at me about something. And the next morning, I thought, you know, I'm going to try and tell him my feelings. I still wasn't all that great about the feeling thing, and this is 27 years sober. I know I'm skipping a bit, but I'm trying to share what happened to me inside, you know. And I sat down in his little study, and I said, you know, Leo, when you bitch at me or complain about stuff just out of the blue like that, it hurts my feelings. And he stood up, and he yelled, and he said, you're always criticizing me. You're always telling me that. And he went on and on about how horrible I was. And I thought, this man has absolutely no clue who I am as a human being. Nothing. I might as well be a blackboard to him, you know? And I came to him a few days later. I said, you know, Leo, he'd been living with me for about a year and a half. I don't like you. And I don't enjoy your company, and I'd like you to move out. And that was like the first step for me to start talking from me with a man, because I didn't know what to do with men, except, well, you know. Because, but anyway, I stayed sober because it's a way to be a good girl, you know, or a good boy. We come in here, and you're supposed to be nice to people, and when you call them names, you're supposed to immediately say, I'm sorry, even if it makes you, you know, and help other people. I mean, the word useful, I have an orange highlighter, my favorite, and it's in these books. This is the Baby 12 and 12 in the Baby Big Book, which I carry with me in my baby AA purse. The word useful is all over the place in here. I started highlighting it a couple years ago. It's just all over the place. Because that's what we're supposed to do. The beginning of the 12 and 12 says, I'm going to read it because I show off and say I know it by heart and then I don't. So, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. I think happily is pushing it, at least in my case. Happy makes me nervous. the end of the Serenity Prayer says that we may be reasonably content in this life and eternally happy in the next. So if there is a next life, eternally sounds like a long dang time to be driving people around in my car, taking them to meetings and stuff. But, you know, if I have to, I have to. Anyway. Everybody's all about the fourth step. Well, what it says in here, you know, we read the promises, which I'll find. Here we go. We say this will always materialize if we work for them. That's step, you know, the promises. Fine. That's the end of step 9. Step 10 says, right, next paragraph. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. I've been doing this for 30 years. I just picked up my 30-year check. It's my lifetime, you know, and it's cool. I have learned, thanks to, I found a good psychiatrist who knew what she was doing with the pills, or she was shooting pills in a barrel and said, here, try this one. I don't know. But she finally got me on something where I was above wet noodle, and I could function better. You know, I was functioning. But I would sit at home at night and play internet, play cards on the internet with complete strangers, just skipping. And so that was in 08. I got on some meds that really worked, and now I'm not just hyper because it's, you know, I'm telling my story and all that. But I've got some pep. You know, I'm 62. I don't run. That's pushing. It's bad for the joints anyway. So let's see what am I doing time wise? Yeah, pretty good. Got plenty of time. Let's see. Sponsoring. I had a period between 2003 and 2010 where I really didn't go to meetings much. I was so tired of that anxiety and the fear of people and not being... Because even though I liked people, I had friends, I couldn't feel it. I just really... You did the least little thing and I was like, oh God, they're going to hurt me. And I just freeze up. So I just kind of pulled myself away from the program. I switched over to rescuing animals, which my mother had done. Well, she rescued him in the sense that she got him fixed, got veterinarians to cooperate with getting him fixed. I literally rescued him and scooped a lot of poop. Oh, crow. And I rescued about 5,000 of them, spayed and neutered them, went to PetSmart. You know, here, wouldn't you like this kitten? I did that for quite a long time. When the meds kicked in, I went, what am I doing? I was living in a horrible trailer up in Commerce, Georgia, and the cats were coming in and out the vents, and every once in a while I'd find a dead one because it would get in the pen with the dogs. It was pretty much a nightmare. You cannot have more than 4 or 5 dogs in one area because they will start killing each other or anything else that's running around. So I kind of brightened up in the head, and I got away from the rescuing, and in 2010 I moved to Gillsville just in time to let my ex move in with me. And, you know, as much as he was an unpleasant individual, he helped me get my double wide, which I had bought and which had been vandalized really badly. He helped me get it fixed up so I could rent it again. So I now have it rented on a pretty regular basis, and I'm not paying 2 mortgages and only living in one. So he helped me, you know. He died this past Thanksgiving from smoke like a chimney, from combination of COPD and pneumonia. And His folks said that right there the last couple of days he was actually nice. He would yell at everybody. It wasn't just me. He had actually become kind of nice and humble in that last year. And so I'm glad for him. You know, I believe even with people with that kind of mental problem that there is a good person in there somewhere. It's almost always comes from some sort of abuse. And I know he was abused by his father. His father is one of these great Santini guys, if you're old enough to remember that movie. You know, and one of these do-it-my-way or the highway guys. And I know it was just very hard for him. So he moved out in 2012, and I'd been going to St. Luke's regularly. When I knew he was moving in, and I knew he shouldn't, and I said yes anyway, my gut, my higher power was yelling, do not let him move back in with you. Are you crazy? And I said, okay, anyway. It's weird when you've been sober a long time and you're doing something that's crazy and you can see yourself doing something that's crazy, and it's you can't stop doing this crazy thing because I thought we'd be happy forever again. Ignoring the fact that even when he wasn't living there, he was screaming at his brother on the phone, screaming about his brother on the phone to me, and I knew he was Fruit Loops, but I thought, oh, he'll be all right once he gets the phone. You know, the hook about the relationship thing, the knight in shining armor, this, you know, soulmate stuff. I'll tell you what saved me, because, of course, this other fella fell into my lap, sort of, when the ex was moving out. And the first week I met him, I'm not a Christian, per se. You know, my higher power is planet Earth. And I've gotten a little closer to considering that there's a comforter, a messenger, that's been by my side since I was a little kid. You know, I can see myself in the beautiful living room in the apartment in New York City with my parents doing their weird thing. And I can see that there was somebody with me saying, Jennifer, I'm really sorry that your parents are the way they are. You deserve better parents. But they're humans. They have egos. They have choice. And they're choosing to do what they're doing. And I'm still alive. I lived through that kind of childhood. I see people nodding. You know about the anxiety. You know about the whack parents who don't give a shit about you. And I'm still alive, and I can tell other people you can live through that. You know, you can live through abusive husbands and wives. I used to call Leo Chief Raging Bullshit. He didn't think it was very funny. I thought it was very amusing. I know that there's a higher power watching over me, and I also have to know that. And my favorite little sentence, which saved me from doing the he's my soulmate thing with this most recent fella, is this little sentence in here. When we developed, this page 116 of the Tonto, when we developed still more, we discovered the best possible source of emotional stability to be God himself. We found that dependence upon his perfect justice, forgiveness, and love was healthy, and that it would work where nothing else would. If we really depended upon God, we couldn't very well play God to our fellows, nor would we feel the urge wholly to rely on human protection and care. And y'all, a lot of you have read that stuff, you know. But that saved my ass from falling into this, he's the one crap again, because he's not the one. But I've learned so much in the past, you know, in the time that he and I were getting to know each other, I guess is the way to say it. I learned that it's me. I have to look at me. I have to look at how I feel. I have to look at, why am I upset? Why do I want to call him and say, you didn't call me 2 weeks? You know, if I'm emotionally unbalanced, I need to do what it says in the book. It's restrain of tongue and pen. Pause. Shut up. Do not email, text, call, lurk in the bushes. I know he's got a woman in there. Oh, please. Or a sheep. That's from a Clancy joke. Clancy says that the epitome of a horrible space to be in when you're sponsoring and watching your daughter get married and she's marrying your sponsee is that you have heard his fifth step. And the only thing you can say is something like, honey, just let me know if he shows up with a sheep. I think that's pretty funny. I love Clancy. He persuaded me that I was an alcoholic because I was, you know, I'm intelligent. I got a nice job and la, 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 la. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. And he said the difference between an alcoholic and a neurotic is that when a neurotic drinks, nothing happens. They're still neurotic. When an alcoholic who's neurotic drinks, it goes boom. And I'm like, that's me. So I'm really grateful that I was spared the last 10 or 15 years of literal hell, at least from physical drinking. And I had to really, really try about the anxiety. I had to find out that my fight-flight thing is busted from not being nurtured as a baby. And now that I know that, my good friend Debbie and her friend Sabrina were the first people that I met when I moved, you know, in 2010, and I started sponsoring Debbie, and I was real upset one day about something, and I hate being vulnerable in front of people. I just, because I'm fine, you know. And I sat on their couch, and I cried, and they held me. And I hadn't let anybody hold me forever, ever, ever. And you just got to try and trust somebody. try two people at once, that's good, because if you try one person and they're having a bad day, you know, I'm just kidding. But really, God, it's hard. And I'm still in this loop. I react to men I'm attracted to the way I did with my father, which was, if he's ignoring me and treating me good one minute and ignoring me most of the time, it must be love. And I know it's not, and that I highly recommend journaling for that reason. I've journaled for over 2 years about the most recent fella, and I can read back at what I was saying and go, oh, crap. You know, most of the time it's the same loop, but that's why we come to meetings, because I can't remember all of this stuff from day to day, but if I come to a meeting, somebody's going to say something, I'm going to go, oh, yeah, I forgot to do that today. Or, oh, I didn't do that. You know, I'm not 20 and I don't have 4 kids and defects. I mean, it's so sad these days when these kids come in and, oh my God. So if you're young, stick with it. I mean, it's just a way of life. It's not a big deal. You just do it every day. It's all right. It doesn't hurt really much, sort of. But you get a sponsor. When I started sponsoring Debbie, I thought, you know, they say you can't ask somebody to sponsor you if they don't have a sponsor. I hadn't had a sponsor in forever. So I got a sponsor, and her ex-husband was a narcissist, and we had a whole ton to talk about. And was that a miracle? Because this was a couple of years ago, and people still don't really talk about narcissism, you know. But it's very painful being involved with someone who's doing this. And mostly this. But the little 5% of this is worth sticking with them for some insane neurotic reason. But I don't drink over it, you see. Because I don't want to be a 62-year-old bar hoe. It was bad enough that I was a 32-year-old bar hoe. Looking at the 42 and the 52-year-old bar hoes and going, Lordy, that was part of the reason I got sober. I thought, I don't want to look like that in 10 years. And be doing what they're doing in the back of those cars out there so they can get a couple more shots. No, thank you. So, let's see. I'm healthy. I don't smoke. I'm still working because I'm so much up to my eyeballs in debt. I'm going to have to work till I'm about 80. But maybe not. I probably have more to say. I did mention God. I skip God a lot. I don't mean to. I have to believe that I can fall back on my higher power. And that even if I remain celibate for the next 23 years, that will be okay. Because I want a true partnership with another human being. I have a true partnership with those 4 lovely ladies that came with me tonight. You know? And it's not about sex. It's not about that. It's that I can feel that they like me. You know, I'm doing the Sally Fields thing inside. I'm going, they like me. You know? And that's what it's about, and I have finally learned what that feeling is. So the guy I was seeing, the little 5% when I was feeling the thing, and then, oh no, we don't have that. Okay, fine. Now I know. I've finally got it the other way around. I know what I'm looking for. I'm looking for someone who says, yes, I like you too. Let's go and play in the sandbox. Wouldn't that be nice? So, stay sober. Get a sponsor. They don't have to scare you. My sponsor is so sweet. But, you know, just keep doing it, damn it. And if you feel like crap, call somebody. Thanks.
Who loves Jennifer? Yeah.